Welcome to the UFO Files, and on the line we have Stanton Friedman, and Stanton is talking to us from his home in Canada, where you said it's going to be, what, 6 below tonight?
No, 6 above.
Oh, okay. Well, I
should... with wind chill, it'll be 6 below.
Yeah. Well, we, you know, throughout the southeast and the east, and here in Oklahoma, we have a little snow on the ground as well, so I guess winter is here.
Yes.
I wanted to talk to you about several things. I know you're into an interesting new project we want to get into in a minute. We always have a lot of fun and enjoy our conversations with you. But first of all, I don't guess you get the Sci-Fi panel, the channel up there in Canada, or do you?
No, the U.S. Sci-Fi channel is not shown here in Canada. I was able to get my son over in Maine to, I live in New Brunswick, which shares a border with Maine, to tape the Roswell program, and I did pick that up, and I've watched that.
Yeah, well, the reason I asked that, because I wanted to make sure. I mean, they said a couple of things about you, and I guess you were actually interviewed for the program as well.
Well, not quite. No, that interview they used is about 5 years old.
Okay.
Couldn't afford to bring me in, I guess.
Yeah, they I thought the narrator went a little out of his way there to kind of knock the NJ-12.
Well, I thought so, too. That was one of a number of concerns that I have. I am so sick and tired of people calling that a hoax. These are the armchair theorists. I've been to 19 archives. I've written a book and several papers, talked to the families of the members, and I have also identified a number of the last generation of NJ-12 documents as frauds, by doing careful investigation, not by doing proclamations. There is a difference between the two, and there are ongoing discussions which illustrate that. Let me give you one silly example, kind of. It's been proclaimed by two different people who had been in the military that all top secret documents have top secret control numbers on them. And since the MJ-12 documents, the Eisenhower briefing document, the Truman-Forrestal memo, and the Cutler-Twining memo, none of them have top-secret control numbers. Obviously, it's a fraud, they say. When you look more deeply, as I have, I even published a couple of top-secret documents without control numbers in my final report on Operation Majestic 12 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And these guys are talking usually about military communications rather than National Security Council and Council and White House stuff. They're not the same. The rules are different. I talked to three different archives, Marshall, Eisenhower, and Truman, and that's General George C. Marshall.
Yes.
And all of those three said we didn't always use top-secret control numbers. As a matter of fact, the archivist at the Marshall Archive said, Stan, if they had to use top-secret control numbers on every top-secret document, we'd still be fighting World War II.
Yeah.
So, but here are these guys making pronouncements. That's just a typical example. Another one is, on one of the documents, the security marking is top-secret restricted. It's on a one-page document that was found in the National Archives, the only original document we have. I mean, we don't have it. The archives have it. You can
right, right,
out.
Right.
And that is an unusual security marking. But the General Accounting Office, buried in its big report about Roswell that they did for Congressman Steve Schiff, mentions that on December 7th, 1994, I guess it was, they were looking at somebody's files up through top secret Air Force files, and they didn't find anything about Roswell, but they noted several instances of the use of top secret restricted, even though they had been told that it was not in use, Majestic 12 in parentheses, at the time. Now, I talked to the three GAO people who were involved, and they said, I said, hey, how do I get copies of those? And they said, they were still classified, Stan. We couldn't make copies of them. And now I got people saying, well, if you can't produce them, then they don't exist. I mean, the GAO's word isn't good enough, you know. So I get a little disgusted with some of this stuff. You spend all this time and effort and energy, and some guy sits in his armchair and finds fault. And I'll listen to everybody, but you know, let's provide a basis. You know, it was like Phil Klass paid me $1,000 for proving him wrong about the typeface on that document.
Yeah, we talked about that in detail in one of our previous shows.
Yeah, I mean, generalizing from 9 pieces of paper to 250,000, they all had to use the same typeface. You know, this is silly. And I get other guys saying those documents are phony because the date format, 18 November, 1952, violates the government style manual. Well, I had one file folder that had 7 different date formats. I published in my 1990 report 3 different items from the Director of Central Intelligence to Ike's office, his military guy, within a 2-week period, and they had 3 different date formats.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is one wrong, one right, and the other 2 wrong? Of course not. It depends on who types it, and these are all limited distribution, classified documents written before the Freedom of Information Act that nobody expected would ever see the light of day. Who cared, you know?
You know, your book about that is still selling well, and a lot of people are still reading it. In fact, we have a link on our website where people can go buy it.
Good.
And, it's just kind of interesting. I thought the narrator, and I don't know his name. I'm sorry, I didn't watch the show. I was working, but I was told that he pretty well just put you in there with the alien autopsy.
Yeah, in one sentence, another fraud was, you know,
yeah,
just like that. And I, as a matter of fact, I felt a little bit like some of those Russian politicians who were airbrushed out of pictures after they were eliminated.
Yeah, yeah, they didn't even bother to do a new interview with you. They just picked up something out of the past. Carl Flock, you know, you guys had had that interesting little debate up there in New Mexico last year.
Yeah, well, that was several years ago.
And the interesting thing about Flock is he seemed to be all over that show, so I don't know.
Well, yeah, I don't know what went on. I don't know why, who decided what. It was mentioned that I and Len Stringfield had originated the Roswell story, or and that isn't true. I started it. I told a guy named Steve Toms in Chicago where to find Jesse Marcel, and he talked to Len Stringfield. So I was there first. Len knows that. I mean, he's dead now, so he knew it before.
Yeah, right.
But you know, there were a number of strange things on the show. Why do they keep showing these large polyethylene balloons for Mogul? You know, these huge things, teardrop-shaped things?
Mm-hmm.
They weren't used for Mogul before the Roswell incident. They used a string, as somebody said on the program, 20 to 25 standard, normal, neoprene weather balloons that you used to be able to buy in surplus stores. And it makes a difference because the neoprene went out in the sun for a few days. It turns into dust practically. And, you know, it loses all its strength. There were, they showed a picture. One of the good things in the program, it's not all bad, was Dr. David Rudiak analyzed or provided his analysis, his reading of the Ramey memo. There's a picture of General Roger Ramey, head of the 8th Air Force, who was the boss, if you will, of Colonel Butch Blanchard, who was the head of Roswell and head of the 509th. Ramey is shown in his office with the phony balloon material. I mean, it's real balloon material, and it certainly isn't Mogul balloon. But in his hand, he's holding a piece of paper that's folded over. And in one of the few pictures that show the piece of paper, the others you can't read it. I mean, the backside is showing. But there's one where you can see that there's print on the paper. Now, these were good quality pictures taken with a good press camera, one of those old 4x5 speed graphic kind of things, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so you blow it up, and I had scans done of the original negative, both sides, and of the several other prints that had been made over the years. I first found the picture 23 years ago. And David has managed to read it using very good software and using, now you got computerized lists. If you know the second, fourth, seventh letter, give me all the other English words, all the English words that have those letters.
Mm-hmm.
And so that restricts your choice pretty heavily, you know. And so that memo, which talks about victims of the wreck, and is apparently from General Ramey to the Chief of Staff of the Air Force, General Hoyt Vandenberg, would seem to prove that there was a crash, despite what the nasty, noisy negativists keep saying.
Yeah, now you told us the story about getting turned onto this down in Louisiana at a television station. When was that, 1977 or something like that?
78. 78. It was in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And, you know, that story is still important because we still have people claiming, as the Air Force did, that the story came to light when the National Enquirer carried an interview with Jesse Marcel, who had gone to them saying he'd recovered wreckage of a flying saucer in 1947. And also in 78, a UFO researcher, Stanton Friedman, met with Marcel and started looking for other witnesses. Now, we've just tabloidized the story.
Mm-hmm.
The fact of the matter is that there was an Enquirer article 2 years later, and by 1980 when that came out, I gave the Enquirer reporter Jesse's address because the reporter had done some fine articles and because the first book was due out, The Roswell Incident by William L. Moore and Charles Berlitz, and Bill and I did 95% of the research. I even got a cut of the royalties, which proves something or other. Anyway, everybody keeps saying Marcel came forward. He never came forward. He wasn't looking for publicity. He didn't run to a tabloid. One academics-oriented book says, of course, you know the Enquirer paid for such stories. Hogwash. I was at the television station in Baton Rouge. I was doing a lecture that night at Louisiana State University, and I was supposed to do three interviews at this one television station for three different programs. You know how it goes at
mm-hmm.
TV stations. And
sure.
I had done the first two, and the third reporter was nowhere to be found. She was late. And the man who managed the station, Johnny Allen, he knew the person who brought me to the station, and he knew that I had other things to do. And he's giving me coffee. We're making idle chit-chat. He's looking at his watch. He's embarrassed, frankly. You don't know where she is. And that was before everybody had cell phones, you know. And while we're sitting there, out of the blue, he says, you know, the guy you ought to talk to is Jesse Marcel. Who's he? Oh, he handled pieces of the wreckage of one of those saucers you're interested in when he was in the military. This is with nobody else around, with a very straight face, clearly serious. And I'm shocked, and I said, well, tell me more. What do you know? Well, he lives over in Houma. I didn't know where Houma was, of course, but I've been there since. And Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually a pretty good-sized town, 100,000 people, I think. Anyway, he's a great guy. We're old ham radio buddies. You ought to talk to him. Well, the reporter then showed up. So the next day from the airport, because I was busy all the rest of the day, I called information. There was a Jesse Marcel listed in Houma. I talked to him. He tells me his story. He doesn't have a date. He's not making a big deal about it. He knew Johnny Allen. They were indeed old ham radio buddies. And he tells me his story, but without a date, how am I going to check on it, you know? A few months later, I'm in Bemidji, Minnesota, at the college, now it's a university there, and after the lecture, two people come up to me and ask quietly, had I ever heard of a crash saucer in New Mexico? Well, yes, I had. They told me their story. Their good friend, Barney Barnett, had told them about stumbling across a saucer with bodies this time. Jesse said nothing about bodies. And they didn't have a date. I got their name and address and passed that on to Bill Moore. And he had a third story. An English actor driving across the United States had heard on a radio program, he was going from L.A. to Philadelphia, about a crash saucer in New Mexico. Nothing about bodies, and they weren't talking alien spacecraft. It was a flying disc, which was kind of a generic term for stuff that was strange and moving around in the sky. And he could pin down the date. He thought it would be a big story when he got to Philadelphia. There was nothing. because it was not a trip you made very often. He remembers, well, late June, early July, 1947. Bill went to the University of Minnesota Library, looked in the periodicals department, and the newspapers of July 8th had the story. In other words, we did it the old-fashioned way, dog work.
Yeah, I understand.
And that gave us a whole bunch of names, and it verified what Jesse had said, incidentally, which was kind of neat. And by 2 years later, Bill and I had talked to 62 people in conjunction with this event. So it had nothing to do with Jesse seeking fame and fortune. I certainly never paid him anything. And the Inquirer didn't either. And we had that was before CD-ROM phone books, you know. So my phone bill used to run $400, $500 a month just trying to track people down. Somebody would say, well, I remember Joe Jones. He was there. The last time I heard, he lived in Oshkosh, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go to try to, you call information, and you call the library to get the city directories. And it's just a lot of work. That's all. It pays off. Any good reporter does that sort of thing.